Good evening, Lumpal.
Good evening, Ajahn Asoko.
Well, thank you for starting the new year with another Q&A. Today is Monday, the 8th of January, 2024. And today I'd like to ask you to say something about a topic you refer to often, which is idealism. If you would be so kind to please just, how do you define idealism and how is it that we hold ideals in ways that are unskillful or skillful?
Well, idealism is basically empty phenomenon. It comes from the brain, the human brain. And we can imagine, because we have language, and we can imagine ideals, like the ideal government, the ideal society, the ideal monastery. We can create ideals with the thinking process. It's all about thinking at its kind of superlative best. And so ideals are usually right and beautiful and good and true. but life as we experience is not, the human experience is not an ideal. And because it's about change and birth and death and decay and sickness, and that's those are not ideal subjects. So the Buddha definitely pointed to old age, sickness and death to be investigated, to be reflected upon, because in our intellect we create ideals. And so, like, democracy in the United States is an ideal, and communism, Marxian communism, is ideal. So these are ideal political systems, but they're creations with taking society and trying to create a perfect society, perfect situation of how things should be. Because we measure experience, if we're caught in attachment to ideals, then we're going to be disappointed, because what we experience is seldom fits that image of an ideal relationship, an ideal job, an ideal profession, an ideal marriage. These are beautiful ideals, but they are empty phenomenon, and when we attach to them, then we become critical and disillusioned, because no matter how hard we try to create an ideal life, it never is ideal. It can't ever, we have moments where it can seem perfect, but those moments change.
Living in a community like here at Amravati seems like an excellent opportunity to watch the mind and how the mind operates in community in terms of wanting an ideal monastery, an ideal teacher, ideal fellow monks and nuns, ideal lay people. Do you have any experience on that scope to share in terms of how it was good learning, good lessons for you?
Well, my personality is very idealistic. As a personality, my ego is based on wanting everything to be perfect and creating perfect situations. And when I became a monk, you know, I carried that into monastic life. So I idealized, when I met Lumpur Cha and Wat Bapong, the monastery in northeast Thailand, I idealized it. And then in those days it was very poor and backward. It had no modern technology, no electricity, no. We had to draw water from the well, and I idolized that, the kind of simplicity of life, simple huts we lived in, and drawing water from the well, and making our own brooms to sweep the paths free from leaves. By the time I was sent to establish Wat Pananachat, I had 8 months of and Wat Bapong was already, I was becoming disillusioned because they were getting electricity, they were building kutis that were very well made, that seemed a bit on the luxurious side, and the monks, there were so many monks coming to people, men to ordain, and they were, I don't know much, I was building his Uposatha hall at that time that I went to Wat Pananachat. And so my ideal was Wat Bapong the first year when it was very basic and primitive. And I wanted to establish that ideal in this branch monastery. And it was just the Wat Pananachat wasn't a wat at all then. It was just a kind of charnel ground for the local village, a haunted forest. And I wanted to just have bamboo huts with grass roofs, and the village men built a sauna with a dirt floor and a grass roof, and I really enjoyed that kind of thing. And at Wat Bapong, they were building this rather exotic temple. But living in, you know, people, I couldn't convince other monks to adopt my ideals, or the lay people, because lay people wanted to build nice kutis and proper sala, and this didn't fit my ideals, so I had to compromise. But the important thing of this subject is being able to see one's attachment to ideals, and that I could do, because I began to see that life is changing and the Northeast Thailand is developing into a very modern, affluent part of Thailand with good roads and electricity and all kinds of modern developments. And my ideal was based on the past, Ubon had changed. Wat Bapong had changed in so many ways that I felt disappointed or critical. And then my resistance to change just made me bitter and critical. It wasn't peaceful. I wasn't content. I was just developing a critical mind towards other monasteries. And I began to be aware of that, you know, that why am I so upset about things like that? And then I began to I remember becoming very upset at when the first year at Watpapo at Watanacha, because none of the monks that came with me were ideal. And I wanted an ideal monastery with ideal monks, and that was impossible.
I think we all find ourselves doing that at one point or another, living in a monastery. But it's suffering, isn't it?
It's suffering. Because it's based on ignorance.
Yeah.
You know, ideals are good, but it's not... But goodness is still a concept. It's a creation of the worldly conditions. You can make the worldly conditions perfect. Perfect human relationships, perfect monks, perfect nuns, perfect monasteries, perfect societies. And you began just to investigate that, wanting things to fit this, to fit my ideal, and nobody could fit, nothing could fit into it. And so the experience was kind of a resentment and negativity. But in Lungpa Cha's style of teaching is to be observant of that. So rather than just becoming kind of resigned to change in a negative way, I began to observe just how my ego, which is based on ideals, because even towards myself as a person, I was highly critical because I'm not an ideal person. Not anywhere near that. And so all I could do is be critical. The criticism would go outward, then go inward, and that attachment to ideals that you imagine, like being a saint, you know, where you're willing to suffer and forgive everybody and love everybody and be pure of heart with never a bad thought. Full of loving kindness and compassion for all sentient beings is an ideal. But as a person, you can't be that way. You can't be, you can at moments feel that kind of beautiful feeling of love for everybody, but then situations change. The time of day changes, the weather changes, the calendar changes. Like this is winter time in England. Is it ideal? No, oh, it's the way it is. But then you'd suffer if you idolized weather to where like it's eternal spring, because spring changes. And having lived in Thailand for so many years, where it's very tropical and warm, you know, it's more like eternal spring than England. But it's also sweaty and hot and a lot of annoying creatures, jungle creatures. And so where is there a perfect place on planet Earth that you can establish an ideal monastery or society? And then teaching of the Buddha is pointing to the way things are rather than how things should be.
So the critical mind, fault-finding mind, is really very much tied up with idealism and idealistic attitudes.
It's a creation, you know, you have to think. You know, thinking is based on division, good and bad, right and wrong, true and false, male and female. All these are words and names But they all have, like, if you have heaven, you've got to have hell. And then if you've got God, you've got to have Satan or the devil. And it's just logical and reasonable. You know, it's how we think. Logic is based on that, on thinking, not on the way things are. And the way things are isn't logical or reasonable, but it is the way it is. So winter in England is like this, and the hot season in Thailand is like this, and then you kind of open up to life as you're experiencing it, rather than trying to control or create the appropriate, keep trying to create your ideals into reality, because that just ends up in being cynical and bitter because nobody can do it.
And whatever we experience here in community life, people experience in family life and professional lives as well.
Well, like in a monastery, in this tradition, you know, you can't be an ideal person, but to ordain, you have to keep the precepts, the Vinaya precepts. And they're about action and speech. So, you know, you say about not to kill any living creature and not to steal or speak badly to someone else. So these kind of rules based on action and speech, we agree to take responsibility for. But what we actually feel and think, you can't be responsible for that. So, but you can be the witness to it. So in terms of what we do or say, we can take responsibility for it, you know, like, not just, we can see something, we might feel we want to steal it, but we don't. That's the agreement. Or sexual desire, you know, sexual forms, these human forms, male and female, and they have that kind of energy. If you act on it, then you have to receive a certain punishment for that, or purification, because we promise not to act on sexual impulses. But we still have them. The body has them. And we're the witness to the body rather than the body itself. So when we start looking at our body with wisdom, then we begin to see that its nature is a sexual form to procreate the species. It gets hungry. It wants to eat good food, and it gets angry, and we experience anger and greed, and we can be totally obsessed with our egos, our sense of a separate self. But in proper meditation, right meditation, we begin to see that we can witness these tendencies, these habits that we've developed through ignorance of the way things are, or what's natural and true.
Like with introspection, with reflection, you point out very often that we can't help the way we feel. And yet we relate very much to emotions, memories and emotions coming from wanting and not wanting. And so in terms of idealism, ideally you'd like to have only pleasant and beautiful emotions, but there's all this messy side of life we have to deal with.
Right, life is basically messy. That's the way it is. Just like right now, winter time, it's been raining for so many days, the field where we go walking is a messy place. And yet in summer it's very ideal. So you know, to want it not to rain in England is a kind of ignorant wish, because England is like this. The weather is like this. When you reflect in this way, then you open the life to experience as you experience through the form, through the body, and through the mind, but you're no longer the body or the mind, the mental conditioning. You're the witness to it. And that's liberation, that's enlightenment.
So you mentioned the early years in Wat Pho Phong and in Wat Nara Chat, but when you came to England and established Amaravati, did you find still ideals were coming and wishes were arising for things to be just perfect, and they were not?
Well, by the time I arrived at Amaravati, I'd had experience at Chitthurst. 5 years in Chitthurst. And that was, the ideal monastery. And it was very beautiful in the forest, and in a very beautiful part of England. We got this incredibly beautiful forest and this old house. And the first 5 years we lived at Chitthurst, and we had to repair this derelict house. It's a mansion, 22 rooms. And it was becoming increasingly ideal. And then the community kept growing. More women came wanting to become nuns, and more monks. More men came wanting to ordain, and we didn't have any place for them to live. And we'd made agreements with the local, what do you call it? The
council.
Council, to limit the population of Chitthurst. And so I thought, well, maybe I should limit the population and just not accept any more people and just be content and stay with Chitthurst on the level that I can control it and keep it ideal. And then I kept thinking, do I really want to, can I really do that? You know, is that, you know, I kept thinking of Rinpo Cha. He kept expanding his monastery, modernizing it, and branch monasteries, and opening up the opportunity for Dhamma meditation to hundreds of men and women. And even though I personally would have preferred to stay at Chitthurst and just settle down there and make a nice, comfortable life and not carry on to establish another monastery, because by that time Chitthurst was quite livable. And then suddenly, you know, I realized I needed to expand. So I started looking for other properties. And then this, what is now Amaravati, became available. In 1984, we moved here. I moved here. And it was, you know, it's on top of a hill. It was much more cold, the weather, and buildings were just wooden hut-like buildings, uninsulated. And the first winter here, it froze all over Europe, and it froze on top of this hill, and it was just totally miserable.
Not ideal.
Not ideal. But by that time, I knew how to deal with it. Because I remember, I've told you this story many times about during that winter of 1984-85. It was 85. And we made the sala livable. We had there were fireplaces, old fireplaces, and about three old fireplaces, and we started using the fireplaces. But only those of us who had seniority could sit near the fire. And Junior Max and Nance were out in the cold, and then we got in electric fires and gas heaters, and became very expensive. The bills, the fuel bills were enormous. And I remember during the winter's retreat, walking, doing the meditation walk outside the sala, and it was very icy, and it had this big tarmac parade ground outside the sala, and I was walking on it, it was frozen over, very icy, and there was one of the lights that the old school that Amaravati used to be had, it was on, and it was kind of a sickly yellow color shining on this ice, and I was really cold walking up and down for an hour, and life got to me, this utter misery. And then I realized that I was quite all right. When I stopped feeling, complaining about it, I felt this sudden surge of joy, of just being present in the situation I was in. And that's an insight. Because, you know, you can imagine how miserable that would be physically. And especially if you're someone that likes warm situations, like myself. And yet, in spite of all that, I suddenly realized my true nature is awareness, conscious awareness. And it doesn't get cold or complain or criticize. It's perfect. It's pure. And suddenly realize perfection doesn't lie in an ideal of perfection, because it's here and now. And that's the awakened state, when we realize the perfect situation here and now is like this, whether it's a pleasant or unpleasant situation that's changing, and it's you know, it's unstable and insecure, even at the best moments of one's life.
So the suffering that arises from idealism is this kind of, like you were describing, resentment, frustration, getting caught up in the critical mind. And then, do you need to get rid of your ideals in order to work with that, or how do you deal with it?
You don't get rid of them, but you stop clinging to them. They're like guiding stars. You know, you can't cling to the guiding star, but it gives you a direction. So before compasses were invented, you know, sailors had to go by the stars, the guiding stars in the sky. So then they had to adapt to the changing conditions, but it kept the direction clear. No matter what the conditions were at sea, it could be calm and smooth and pleasant, or wave, you know, typhoons or whatever would arise in the world. That it can be at moments very calm and peaceful and beautiful, and the next moment change into a tsunami, a cyclone or typhoon. And we've lived long enough to experience the changingness of when we have perfect situations on the worldly level, that there's always the fear that they're going to lose them, because they change, and they don't change the way we always change the way that we want them to change. So ideals are we don't get rid of them, but we no longer cling to them, but we can use them, like the perfect monastery is more like a guiding star than something you have to create.
Is that what Lopa Cha was talking about when he was telling you true but not right, right but not true? It's how to relate to these things, isn't it?
Like one of the great monks of Thailand told me when in Wat Pa Phong everything was based on Vinaya, on keeping every precept properly. And when I went to visit this very wise monk in the southern part of Thailand, he said, if you're mindful, you don't need Vinaya. And that shocked me, because I thought, well, according to Wat Pa Phong, you need to keep Vinaya, otherwise you can't get enlightened. So I went back to Wat Pa Phong and told Ajahn Chah, and his reply to me was, because Ajahn Chah admired this monk very much, and Lumpa Cha smiled and said, true but not right, right but not true. And that's a conundrum that I found very helpful, because according to reason and logic, right, if it's true, it's right, and if it's right, it's true. And that's idealism. But it shows the kind of true but not right, right but not true is a good conundrum to contemplate. Because my mind, it said right and true are there, then that's, if it's true, it's right. If it's true, if it's right, it's true. And that's logic and reason, but it's not the way things are.
Thank you very much, Lumpur.